effusive introduction. I'm not sure whether I can live up to that. I also want to thank Aidan for organizing the evening here and the splendid facilities we have, including the microphone, which is going to save my voice. Also Russell Napier, without whom this wouldn't be taking place at all. Russell has been a good friend for many years, and my main involvement with his activities is through the course on practical financial history. And if you're here tomorrow morning at 8 o'clock in the morning, you will hear me deliver another lecture. But tonight it's the Hong Kong dollar, and I've entitled it The Hong Kong Dollar Crisis of 1983, What Really Happened. And I'm going to divide it into 5 segments. First, I'm going to explain for some of you what a currency board is. Are there people who need to understand what a currency board is? Yes, all right, okay. We'll spend a moment or two on that. Balance sheets, that's Robert. Then we'll talk about what happened with the Hong Kong dollar after the Second World War, really up until the 1970s. And then the immediate post-war period, excuse me, and then up until the 70s. And then really kind of what went wrong, how everything became derailed in the period 1972 to 74. And then sort of really what actually happened, which is the final bit. So that's the agenda. And because this is about something that was sort of a big part of my life, I actually wrote a book on it, which looks like that in hardback and looks like that in softback. I have some surplus copies to sell if anybody's interested afterwards, but I just brought 5 along with me. But it's obviously obtainable elsewhere. So, currency boards. When Hong Kong started out, when the British seized Hong Kong in the 1840s, the currency of the day in the China region and subsequently was silver. And what was very widely used was silver coins minted either in Mexico, the Mexican trade dollar, or in the United States. So I have here, now these I bought just a few years ago in Burma, in Myanmar. This one is dated, this from the US, dated 1804, so long before Hong Kong became a colony. This stuff was circulating in Asia. And this Mexican one is dated 1898. So, you know, long way apart, but the point is that China was on the silver standard, and silver was the key currency. In point of fact, China actually had subsidiary coins that were called copper cash, which were convertible into silver at a fixed exchange rate. There's been a wonderful book written recently in Hong Kong by somebody I refer to as the Hermit of Hong Kong, explaining how China completely mismanaged its currency system during the 19th century. This fellow has acquired a collection of no less than about 7 tons of copper cash coins from every single mint in China through each imperial dynasty, through the Qing dynasty. And he's effectively shown that the mismanagement was really the cause of the humiliation of China during the 19th century. It was just so disorganized that the emperor couldn't even pay the soldiers to fight the foreigners, and hence the repeated defeats and humiliation at the hands of foreigners. I won't pass these round as I do sometimes in class, but if you want to come up afterwards and sort of look at them. I also have, just to make the collection complete, a piastre from the French, from French Indochina, basically the same sort of thing. So that was the currency at the time. And the way that that operated, when banks were authorized or given charters to do business in Hong Kong, which was roughly from the 1860s, sorry, I can't get it so everybody can see it. I don't know whether you can see. But basically, I'll move it around. And basically, banks were given the authority to issue notes against silver coin or silver bullion. So they had silver assets and banknotes, which were the liabilities. And then they would have their main part of the balance sheet, the loans and vault cash, some issued cash, and then deposits and capital. So that's kind of how things looked. And in those days, the issue of notes was really very important. And the promises on the notes said something like, well, they said exactly this. This is a Hong Kong and Shanghai Banking Corporation note. The Hong Kong and Shanghai Banking Corporation promises to pay the bearer on demand at its office here in Hong Kong $10 or the equivalent in the currency of the colony, full stop, value received. We, the bank, have received 10 silver dollars and we have them in our vault. This piece of paper represents that. So banknotes are fundamentally just warehouse certificates representing some asset of the bank. In Britain and the gold standard countries, it was gold. Japan had iron for a time. Some provinces in China had copper, depending on what they produced. And furthermore, these notes are hand-signed by two managers. This one is dated 1923. This one is dated 1930, also from Hong Kong and Shanghai Bank. And this one is from the Chartered Bank of India, Australia, and China, nowadays the Standard Chartered Bank. And again, it has two signatures, and this one is dated 1934. So that was running along until 1934, 35. But then what happened was that the Americans, in the depths of the Depression, there was big unemployment in the commodity-producing industries because commodity prices collapsed. And various senators and congressmen lobbied for the price of silver to be raised. And in 1934, the Congress passed and the president signed the Silver Purchase Act, which raised the price of silver from a then prevailing price of something like 29 cents an ounce to $1.25. So the Treasury agreed to buy silver for this elevated price. And it's just like buying corn or grain or something. You support the farmers by promising a higher price. So that created lots of demand for silver, and silver miners went back to work. Great for America. The problem for China and other countries that were using silver was that their exchange rate quadrupled in value. So it would be like the pound today, suddenly becoming sort of worth $4 or something like that, which would decimate our export industry. The effect of that was to force Hong Kong and other countries territories that were using silver to abandon silver. And I'll explain how they did that in just a moment. But the monetary lesson of this kind of episode is that it shows that the world can never have a commodity standard. Because if that commodity can be manipulated, let's say we went back and we had a gold standard, big producers like Russia or Australia or whatever, or South Africa, could move the price. And if your exchange rate is subject, the exchange rate is probably the most important single price in any economy, other than the three-month interest rate, then your economy is going to be handicapped or subject to the whims of whoever can set the gold or silver price. So the problem was what to do, and this is the solution that was devised in Hong Kong. In the British colonies, there were a number of currency boards, and they worked like this. So this is a standard currency board. They would issue banknotes in, let's say, East Africa against sterling submitted by the banks. So whatever, let's say, the Chartered Bank or Barclays or whoever would submit pounds sterling and receive East African shillings at a fixed rate, and then these circulated. Now, and the banks would have this sort of standard balance sheet without this bit. They would operate here, this normal part of the balance sheet. Now, in Hong Kong, because silver was now sort of inappropriate, and the banknotes, you know, it was very difficult to issue banknotes because you had to pay so much silver. What was decided was that they would abandon the silver standard and substitute a sterling standard. So the government took over the silver reserves of the banks with passed legislation, took over the silver reserves of the banks, and sold the silver on world markets at a very good price, and issued in exchange certificates of indebtedness, CIs as they're called, to the banks. So the banks now held CIs as backing for the banknotes. These CIs, incidentally, were denominated in Hong Kong dollars. And with the sale of the silver, they used the proceeds to buy sterling securities, so gilts. So the exchange fund, which is the Hong Kong Currency Board, was set up in this simple way. It received payments. Going forward, it would receive payments in pounds from the banks, authorizing them to issue banknotes. If you consolidate this, obviously, these cancel out. So now the backing for the banknotes is sterling. Okay, so that's what happened in Hong Kong in 1935. In China, unfortunately, they didn't do that. They went on to a paper standard, and this was China under, I'm not quite sure when Chiang Kai-shek took over, but basically the printing presses started whirring faster and faster. There was the war with the Japanese and then the Civil War, and ultimately there was a hyperinflation in China between 1945 and 1949. But Hong Kong had a very stable currency because the currency was fixed to sterling. However, during the war, the Japanese occupied Hong Kong, and they came in so quickly that some of the banks in Hong Kong were unable to hide or burn their unissued banknotes. So they had a stock of unissued banknotes, which they were ready to sort of pay sterling for, but they hadn't done so. So the Japanese rounded up the bankers, made them sit down and sign the banknotes under duress, under pressure. The notes were therefore called duress notes, and of course they were unbacked. They were not backed by sterling. They issued, there was 121 million, nearly 122 million Hong Kong dollars worth, which at the time was quite a lot of money, compared with an outstanding note issue at the time of 290 million. But now, so as the fortunes of war sort of fluctuated, when the Japanese were doing well, the unbacked notes rose in value. When the Japanese were doing poorly and the Allies were making progress, the price of the unbacked notes sank. So there was an exchange rate between the notes that were genuinely sterling-backed and those that were not. The bankers had remembered the numbers, the serial numbers, and of course that got widely known. So when the Allies won the war, there came the question of what to do about the duress notes. And it was decided after some time that the government would honor them. But the result was that there were then many more banknotes outstanding than there was cover or assets backing the notes. So there was a shortfall. The legislation had said that these securities must always be at a minimum 105% of the value of the outstanding banknotes. So there was clearly a shortfall. And so it was decided that they would honor these notes, but they would no longer publish the accounts of the exchange fund in order to maintain confidence. And this is important because, for me, what it meant was that the authorities, having decided not that the accounts would remain secret, in 1953, a statement was made in the Legislative Council by the Financial Secretary to the effect that the assets of the exchange fund now covered the note issue, no problem. But they, in a typical bureaucracy, they decided not to publish, and they continued that right up until the 1990s, which for me meant that it was very difficult to figure out what was going on in Hong Kong, that is, how the monetary system worked, and that was among the challenges. So that's kind of a sort of first couple of segments. We've talked about the currency boards and then the restoration of the Hong Kong dollar in the post-war period. My third little section is on sort of what happened between roughly 1947 when they agreed to honor the unbacked notes and 1972. Now, between 47, when sterling became convertible after World War II, and 1972, although, of course, sterling had exchange controls, it wasn't fully convertible in the sense that we would think about that now. But basically, sterling remained a fundamentally weak currency. To support its value, Britain maintained foreign exchange controls within the so-called sterling area. Now that, nowadays, we would call that the Commonwealth. Of course, the Commonwealth didn't exist then, but basically the colonies, the dominions, etc., that were subject to British financial monetary control and rule. Despite that, prices in the UK continued to rise much more rapidly than in Hong Kong and in many other places. Consequently, sterling was devalued three times. In September 1949, from $4.03 to $2.80. In November 1967, this was the famous Wilson devaluation, the pound in your pocket and all that, from $2.80 to $2.40. And then again in June 1972, having recovered somewhat, thanks mainly to the depreciation of the dollar, between August 1971 and February 1972, the currency was allowed to float downwards, and it went from 260 back down to 245. So there were these series of devaluations. From Hong Kong's perspective, the problem was that they had their reserves in sterling, right? So every time the pound went down, and they were doing most of their trade now with the US, and most of the capital movements were denominated in dollars, Hong Kong felt that it was severely disadvantaged. In 1949, with that first devaluation, Hong Kong kept its rate of $16 to the pound, so it underwent an equal devaluation with sterling. But in 1967, when the pound was devalued from 280 to 240, initially Hong Kong devalued in line with Britain, because that's what they'd done before, so you do it again, right? That's the bureaucratic rule. But then they discovered, of course, that the price of food imported into Hong Kong from mainland China shot up because China didn't devalue. So prices of food imported from the mainland into Hong Kong were much more expensive, and this started to cause all kinds of political and social unrest. And consequently, the Hong Kong authorities later revalued their currency from 16 up to 14.55, equal to £1, leaving a net devaluation of about 6% versus the Wilson devaluation of more than twice that. So Hong Kong was starting to diverge a bit from the motherland, or from the UK. And then in June 1972, twice burned by sterling devaluations, the 49 and 67 episodes, and with the exchange fund experiencing a loss of $913 million in 1972, Hong Kong decided enough is enough, and they decided to shift from a sterling peg to a US dollar peg at the then going rate of $5.65 to one US dollar. The government didn't compensate the banks in any way. They were expected to just shoulder that loss. They had been operating their books so as to ensure that they would not be sort of short sterling. And of course, when sterling was devalued, they probably lost some as well. So it wasn't just the government, it was the banks as well. Other things that were going on during this period up to 1972, Hong Kong had its first banking ordinance in 1948. Prior to that, there'd been no banking ordinances, just banks were chartered and that was it. The government just was not involved in the administration or supervision of banks. After a number of runs on small banks in 1961, 65, and 67, the banking ordinance was revised. And in 1974, for the first time, they introduced specified liquid asset ratios, which was set at some number like 25%. But because foreign exchange counted as a liquid asset, banks were easily able to borrow foreign exchange, and it was no constraint on their activity. And then finally, in 1964, following an interest rate price war among the banks, the government insisted that an interest rate agreement among the licensed banks be implemented, and the Hong Kong Association of Banks was set up to regularly sort of adjust these deposit interest rates. The enforcement through the Hong Kong Association of Banks worked because there was an implicit threat that if banks didn't comply, then they would lose their membership of the clearinghouse and they wouldn't be able to operate in Hong Kong. So a combination of government powers on licensing, the Hong Kong Association of Banks' control over interest rates, meant that the industry was basically cartelized. It was a comfortable arrangement of fixed number of banks, and things were pretty comfortable. Spreads were pretty wide. Banking was a good business. But of course, the outside world was changing rapidly. In 1971, President Nixon closed the gold window, which effectively signed the death warrant for the Bretton Woods system of fixed exchange rates, and the world gradually moved towards floating rates. So we now move to my fourth section, which is on the period 1972 to 74. I'm homing in on that because that's really when things went badly wrong in Hong Kong. Two important changes were made during this period. First, in July 1972, and second in November 1974. Now, the first change was that whereas previously the exchange fund had always insisted on payment of pounds from the banks to the exchange fund in exchange for these entitlements to issue Hong Kong dollar banknotes. Of course, they had shifted so that this was no longer pounds. They had now adopted the US dollar, so it was now appropriate to hold US dollar securities, treasury bills, and so on. But they decided that, really, since they were moving away from the ambit of the UK, it was no longer necessary to pay sterling. And so they said to the banks, you can pay in Hong Kong dollars, which is a most extraordinary decision, but it was done. At the time, they had plenty of, they'd built up reserves in excess of the amount of banknotes, partly because they were earning interest regularly and interest rates had been pretty high. But in addition, some of the fiscal surpluses of the Hong Kong government were channeled to the Exchange Fund for Management. And as a result, these foreign securities held by the Exchange Fund were well in excess of the banknotes outstanding. So they decided it wouldn't matter if the banks paid in Hong Kong dollars in future for the entitlement to issue banknotes. I think the thinking went along the following lines. Since the tie to sterling was no longer valid, and most of Hong Kong's trade and capital movements were denominated in US dollars, the colony could earn ample foreign exchange reserves to deal with any situation that might arise. However, of course, by cutting the link between monetary growth in Hong Kong and monetary growth in the currency to which the Hong Kong dollar was now pegged, that is the US dollar, Hong Kong was entering a kind of monetary no man's land. The automatic linkage between the Hong Kong dollar and sterling on the wholesale exchange rate market and the deposit interest rates had been maintained at least in part by the fact that that cash exchange rate was fixed previously from banknotes via CIs to sterling, and therefore the price of deposits couldn't deviate too much from the price of banknotes, since deposits were always convertible into banknotes. Now, vis-a-vis the US dollar, although there was nominally a fixed rate, in fact, the banks weren't obliged to support that fixed rate, and they didn't issue currency against that fixed rate. Not surprisingly, the exchange rate began to drift away from the supposed fixed rate of 5.65 per US dollar, and this required the exchange fund to start to intervene in the foreign exchange market in an attempt to maintain that rate. But needless to say, that wasn't going to work, because the exchange fund at the time didn't have any sort of control over the banks other than through the banknote issue. It didn't have accounts with the banks, and the banks certainly didn't have an account with the exchange fund. They did build up Hong Kong dollar deposit accounts. If I could squeeze that in here. Hong Kong dollar deposit accounts held at the banks, so there would be deposits here held by the public, P, and by the government, the exchange fund. But if you think about it, what's happening here is that the exchange fund is behaving just like a large corporation. Instead of controlling the banks through reserves or anything like that, it had become a customer of the banking system. So the whole system was kind of turned upside down. Instead of the exchange fund controlling and managing the system, it was just like a sort of Jardines or Hutchison or Swire or somebody was a large depositor. But if it intervened in the foreign exchange market, it would draw down these deposits. And what would happen to them? They would be sold to somebody else. And they just reappeared in the system. So there was no multiple contraction or multiple expansion effect from exchange fund operations during this period. So that was, if you like, mistake number one. Library of mistakes. So the mistake was to eliminate the requirement to pay a fixed price in foreign currency for the right to issue Hong Kong dollars. The second change was that as these deviations from the 565 rate, 565 Hong Kong dollar, 5.65 Hong Kong dollars to per US dollar, became larger and the need for intervention increased, the Hong Kong authorities no doubt began to feel more and more frustrated. In February 1973, the US dollar was devalued by 10%. The Hong Kong dollar was revalued upwards to offset that dollar devaluation. It was now valued at 5.085 Hong Kong dollars per US dollar. Eventually, the Hong Kong authorities threw in the towel and announced on November 26, 1974, that the Hong Kong dollar would be allowed to float. This time, their thinking must have gone along the following lines. The world is moving to a floating rate system, and intervention in Hong Kong's foreign exchange market was evidently not working, and it was costing them more and more. So we in Hong Kong should simply float the currency like most other countries are choosing to do, right? Right thing to do, right? Well, that produced its own problems. I'll just quickly eliminate this, and we'll with that decision, the Hong Kong dollar entered uncharted waters. From the 1860s, the colony's dollar had always had a fixed rate to silver or to a foreign currency, first the pound and then the dollar, except during the Japanese occupation. And now there was no such link, it was floating. The changes of 1972 and 74 now began to have their full effects. First of all, monetary growth became highly erratic, with the broad money supply in Hong Kong accelerating from 5% growth at the start of 1974 to 40% by 1980. At the peak of the 1973-4 inflation in this country, we had money growth of 24-25%, something like that. Horrific. This is double that. And then after that, the money growth rate plunged to almost zero in 1983. Now, watching this in Hong Kong, I was appalled, you know, because money was just behaving like a yo-yo, very unstable. Everybody said, oh, but the Cantonese, they're all big bettors. They like to bet at Happy Valley, and it's the same with the monetary system. I said, no. It's the system that's unstable. We need to fix the system. And I started doing serious research on the system. Well, that was one set of effects. The second set of effects was, not surprisingly, inflation surged to a higher rate than at any time since World War II. From 1974 to 1983, the consumer price index increased by about 128%. That compared to 102% in the US, 209% in Britain, so Britain was still inflating like crazy, and 95% in Japan. So Hong Kong was certainly up there among the inflators. The Monetary Affairs branch of the Hong Kong government, which was responsible for managing the exchange fund and the monetary system, that they had a banking commissioner who supervised the implementation of the banking ordinance, from, if you like, the regulatory agency. But the Monetary Affairs branch introduced an attempt to try to control liquidity by requiring the banks to keep 100% liquid asset cover against deposits of the exchange fund designated short term. So they would place some of these deposits with the banks and say, these are short term deposits, you must hold liquid assets. But of course, that didn't change the quantity of money in any sense, didn't reduce it, it just changed the composition of the bank's balance sheets. And since the banks could create liquid assets by borrowing foreign currency, as I mentioned, the measure had no effect. And in addition, since the exchange fund was a customer of the banking system, i.e. it held deposits at the banks instead of the banks holding deposits with the exchange fund, it was no more able to manage the exchange rate than any large corporate customer of the banks. Interventions in the foreign exchange market did not add to or subtract money from the system. They simply transferred deposits from the account of the exchange fund to the account of the buyer or seller, as the case may be, leaving the quantity of Hong Kong dollar deposits and therefore the money supply unchanged. More fundamentally, the problem was that the system had now degenerated into a mechanism in which there was no control over either the price, that is the exchange rate of the Hong Kong dollar, or the quantity or money supply. Those of you who learned economics will know that, you know, I suppose if you can summarize any market with a price and a quantity, and you have a supply curve and a demand curve, and typically what would happen in a currency board system, the way to describe it is that you would have a price which is the exchange rate. That would be fixed. And then the demand for currency would gradually increase. But because the price was, the fixed exchange rate was kept stable, the system would accommodate an increase in demand, but they would just issue a bit more currency to accommodate that. But now, with this floating rate system, this was gone. So, well, the demand is still there. But the question is, you know, at what level does it settle? The authorities no longer set a fixed exchange rate for banknotes, and the rate set by banks in the foreign exchange market was no longer related, as it had been in the past, to the rate for banknotes. Moreover, the authorities had never had any ability to control the money supply. It had been set indirectly. They issued coins or notes or the entitlements to issue notes at a fixed exchange rate, but they'd never intervened in the wholesale foreign exchange market. The system was now in what is technically called a meta-stable equilibrium. Sorry about that one, but some of you might enjoy this. It looks like, visually, it looks like this. One way of visualizing it is as follows. I don't know if you can all see this. Imagine something like this. And let's say you have a ball here. If that system is shocked, and the ball is moved either this way or that way, you know, it could sort of crash that way or crash that way. But it's unknowable which way it's going to go. And essentially, that's what Hong Kong had. It was now, the government couldn't control the quantity because they didn't have a monetary base that they could manage with the banks, and they didn't fix the exchange rate. So the exchange rate could settle here. And that could happen, you know, these kind of movements could happen without any change in the quantity of money. You could have a sudden shift, you know, from this level to this level, vice versa. And this was a kind of eureka moment for me in Hong Kong, because I did the analysis and wrote up the papers which basically form the basis of this book in my little journal, Asian Monetary Monitor. And when I realized this, it was obvious that if some crisis occurred, the Hong Kong dollar was going to plummet because the government could do nothing about it. The other way to describe it, just forgive me indulging one more thing for the mathematicians here. The other way to describe the system is to say that it was a system of two simultaneous equations with three unknowns. And from that, for those of you who remember your sort of high school math or algebra, if you've got a system like that, you have an infinite number of solutions. So the Hong Kong dollar could be anywhere. And it looked like this to use. So the price level was basically determined by a function of the nominal quantity of money and the real income level, which we can express like that. These terms, don't worry about them. You're not going to be tested afterwards. Or alternatively, the money supply was equal to, or was determined by, the function of the exchange rate, E, and the real quantity of money, the amount of money in real terms that people wanted to hold. Now, we've got two equations here, and these are nominal variables. The price level, the money supply, and the exchange rate. Two equations, three unknowns. Anything could happen, right? In the old days, they had fixed the exchange rate, and that basically, fixed the money supply, which in turn fixed the price level, okay? Alternatively, you could have a central bank which controlled the money supply. That would control the exchange rate, and it would also control the price level. Okay, so, as I say, Hong Kong had entered a kind of no man's land with these developments. The question is, why had this been allowed to happen? Now, in my view, I'm going to be a bit rude here. In my view, the people running the system had no real understanding of monetary systems. Starting at the top, the financial secretary, Sir Philip Haddon-Cave, who held office as financial secretary from 1971 to 1981, was widely regarded, I think you'll agree, as erudite and scholarly, yes? Having trained at the University of Hobart, Tasmania, and then at King's College, Cambridge, before becoming a colonial administrator in Kenya, the Seychelles, and then Hong Kong. He was famous for promoting the doctrine of, quote, positive non-interventionism, unquote. We won't go into that. However, in my opinion, at least in the area of monetary economics, the emperor had no clothes. After one of his sort of 3 or 4 hour budget speeches, I wrote an article pointing out that his analysis essentially separated the real economy, that is, things like consumption, investment, government spending, exports, from anything to do with the monetary system. So essentially, he said that the real economy did A and B, inflation did C and D, and the exchange rate did E and F, and they were all unrelated. These were just facts. There was little or no linkage in his analysis between the real and nominal variables. I don't believe that he'd ever studied or understood monetary economics or monetary systems. The other person was the man in charge of the monetary affairs branch from 1976 to 1985 was Douglas Bly, an accountant by training. Now, on one occasion in 1981, he summoned me to a meeting with the new financial secretary, Sir John Bembridge, a businessman from the Swire Group recruited to the administration. And he summoned me to admonish me for an article entitled Time to Blow the Whistle on the Hong Kong Dollar, or on the Hong Kong Dollar System, published in the July-August issue of the Asian Monetary Monitor in 1981. He accused me of precipitating instability, being disloyal to Hong Kong, and for making factual errors in the article. You remember, because they kept all these accounts secret, there was nothing that you could sort of report on factually. So the problem was to establish the principles on which it worked, which is essentially what the article was about. And I'd had some help on this from academics. But my answer was, my response was simply, are the basic principles on which the system operates different from the ones set out in my article? And he just didn't answer. I received no answer, and indeed I was cold-shouldered by the administration for two more years. So that's 1981, and it wasn't until 83 that the crisis happened. So much for the analysis of the mechanism. Now comes the easy part. In September, I think it was 81 or was it 82, Margaret Thatcher visited Beijing to discuss with Deng Xiaoping what would happen to Hong Kong after the lease on the new territories expired on June 30th of 1997. The Chinese attitude was, well, that was an unequal treaty. We never acknowledged it anyway. We want Hong Kong back, period. The British view for a long time was, they tried to fudge it. Well, maybe we could have British administration but Chinese sovereignty. Chinese said, forget it, that's never going to work. We want Hong Kong back. And then, now with that kind of confrontation going on, of course, things went, the view in the markets was pretty negative. Negotiations were held roughly every 6 to 8 weeks between British and Chinese diplomats, rather like Brexit. When things were perceived to be going negatively or badly, the Hong Kong dollar would fall because it's floating. And when things were going well, it would rise again because it was floating. Now the problem was this, that if people wanted to get assets out of Hong Kong, say they had a business, you couldn't move the business out of Hong Kong. You had to sell the business, get Hong Kong dollars, and then sell the Hong Kong dollars, right? Well, initially in the negotiations, things went very, very badly, so the Hong Kong dollar started to crumble quite quickly. A capital flight developed, which basically destabilized the metastable equilibrium here. So if you like, this was shot over the hump, and as I've explained, the authorities were unable to intervene, or even if they did intervene, it wasn't going to work. And therefore, the Hong Kong dollar started falling pretty rapidly from the mid-fives, 550, somewhere around there, and eventually to 960 or 980. So it roughly halved in value by August, September 1983. And what precipitated that moment of crisis in August and September of 1983 was another dispute in the negotiations over land rights and things like that. Now, there are people in the audience who lived in Hong Kong during this time, but and I'd be really pleased if during the Q&A session if you could contribute, but I remember very well the runs on supermarkets. What was happening was that the Hong Kong dollar was falling very fast. Hong Kong imported almost everything, its water, its food, its meat, its vegetables, all sort of major durables. Very little was manufactured in Hong Kong except some clothing and some footwear and a few plastic vials and things like that. So there was a run on the so people's real. The real value of their wages was plummeting, but they weren't being paid any more. In fact, at the time, the Hong Kong, the money supply wasn't growing at all. So in terms of this diagram, what happened was that the Hong Kong dollar plummeted in value. There wasn't any increase in the quantity of money. It just plunged. There was a sudden shift in the demand for Hong Kong dollars. Nobody wanted to hold it anymore. So what happened was what you see in hyperinflation, that velocity started to rise. And one way that velocity, higher velocity, expresses itself is that people exchange money for hard goods, tangible goods. So they all ran to the supermarkets, bought rice, cooking oil, tissue paper, toilet paper, all essentials like that. The supermarkets were cleared out, and it was really quite scary over one particular weekend, because none of the stuff was available and people were panicking, you know, that the whole thing was going to fall apart. Well, my involvement was as follows. I'd written two or three articles in my journal, Asian Monetary Monitor, which are reproduced in the book. I'd written two or three articles saying that the Hong Kong monetary system wasn't working. They needed a central bank to fix the money supply or manage the exchange rate. And as I explained, I got the cold shoulder on this. Well, in July, August of 1983, I went on holiday. I went on a diving holiday to Palau, which is in Micronesia. I'm a scuba diver. And on one particular day between dives, we were resting on an island, and I was lying under the coconut tree. And I had another eureka moment. I suddenly realized that actually what I'd been proposing was not going to be accepted, because in the midst of a crisis, they weren't going to suddenly change all the financial and monetary institutions and set up a central bank. But it dawned on me that actually all we had to do was to revert to the old system, fix the Hong Kong dollar in terms of a foreign currency, make the banks pay for the CIs at a fixed rate in US dollars and pay that to the exchange fund, and basically the problem would be solved. That would fix the Hong Kong dollar. Now this was, it was very sensitive, or the exchange rate and the mechanism was very sensitive, because at the time the Chinese, the mainland, was accusing the British of undermining the Hong Kong dollar deliberately in order to destabilize Hong Kong, so that once it was handed over, there would be, so to speak, nothing left. Well, of course, that wasn't the intention. It was just that they had a monetary system which was, as you'd say, as people would say nowadays, not good for purpose. So, lying under the coconut tree, I had this realization that instead of proposing either a central bank to manage the money supply or a central bank to manage the exchange rate, there was a third option, and that was to fix the Hong Kong dollar by means of a currency board mechanism. And so I went back to Hong Kong and I wrote up this paper called How to Rescue the Hong Kong Dollar, Three Practical Proposals. And those three were exactly what I wrote. Now I wanted to get, I felt very isolated. I couldn't get other analysts to understand. People didn't, you know, they weren't trained to understand monetary systems. So I wanted to get strong academic support. So I got on the phone to Milton Friedman, who was then living in San Francisco. And as Robert explained, I'd met him on a number of occasions and become very friendly with him. And he was a keen reader of my Asian Monetary Monitor. And I said, look, this is the problem. What do you, you know, here, and here's my proposed solution. He said, that'll work, sure, do it, you know, instant. So I sent him the papers, and he followed up with, and I had a few questions, and we had a few conversations. Another academic support that I looked for was Alan Walters. He was the economic advisor, you remember, to Margaret Thatcher. At the time, he was living in Washington, and one of my seniors in the company knew him quite well. So I arranged for my paper to be couriered first to London and then to Washington for hand delivery to Alan Walters. And as soon as Alan read it, he'd written about the Malaysian currency board. So he knew about these things, and he was a monetary scholar too. He said, we've got a major problem here. We'd better have a meeting in Washington. Now, as it so happened, this was September, end of August, beginning of September, and that's exactly when the IMF World Bank meetings are held. Margaret Thatcher was going over to Canada and then to Washington to see Ronald Reagan. All the senior brass from the Bank of England were coming over, the governor, you know, the head of the international department, etc., the chancellor of the exchequer, they were all there. And Margaret Thatcher, on Alan's suggestion, said, right, we will hold a meeting at the British Embassy in Washington on Tuesday, and we will discuss this and decide what we're going to do. So they decided what they were going to do. They were going to adopt the plan, but it had to be seen to be a decision of the Hong Kong government. Margaret Thatcher said to Alan Walters, I'd like you to go out there and really check it out in more detail and go through it with the banks. He, for personal reasons, he couldn't go out at that time. So they decided to send Charles Goodhart, who was the head of what was then called intelligence at the Bank of England. He was head of research, and a man called David Perez from the Treasury. So those two were sent out to Hong Kong essentially to vet the scheme and to give it the sort of good housekeeping seal of approval. And the other man I consulted with was a brilliant guy, and sadly he's passed away now. Well, they've all passed away. Maxwell Fry, who was at Birmingham University at the time and doing some work for the Asian Development Bank in Manila, and came to visit me in Hong Kong, and we had a lot of discussions, and he'd helped me formulate some of the aspects of the paper. Well, there was then a frenetic sort of bit of activity by the Hong Kong government. They had an urgent meeting on a Saturday in the morning to review my plan. They made an announcement on the Sunday and hinted that they were going to adopt this. One of their problems was that Bremeridge was out of the colony, the financial secretary. He was at the IMF meetings in Washington, and before that there'd been a Commonwealth finance ministers meeting somewhere in the Caribbean. Anyway, they made this interim announcement in Hong Kong, and then there was the visit of Goodhart and Perez to Hong Kong, and they had time with me as well. And I remember taking Charles up onto the peak, and we walked around the peak and talked about, you know, monetary matters all the way around. So these were exciting times, and they were going to make an announcement, and then the typical Hong Kong thing happened. There was a typhoon which blew in, so they delayed the announcement, and ultimately it was announced, I think, on October the 15th, that the Hong Kong government was going to change the monetary system in exactly the way that I said. They fixed the rate at a slightly different level. I had recommended eight Hong Kong dollars per US dollar, because eight is a lucky number in China and in Hong Kong, but they decided that they wouldn't, you know, sort of buy the whole plan, hook, line, and sinker, so they were going to differentiate it by fixing it at 780. So today the Hong Kong dollar, US dollar rate is fixed at 7.80. So, just to conclude, basically what had happened was that, as I kind of pointed out, instead of the commercial banks or licensed banks holding Hong Kong dollar deposits with the monetary authorities, we had this peculiar system in which the Hong Kong monetary authorities were holding domestic currency deposits with the commercial banks, the exact opposite to orthodox systems. So, to get back to library of mistakes, the mistake was they kind of inadvertently inverted the monetary system. And needless to say, that caused a lot of problems. This undermines the multiple expansion or multiple contraction mechanism, which is fundamental to the operation of an orthodox central banking system, or for that matter, a traditional colonial currency board system, of which Hong Kong's exchange fund was a variant. And with that, I will stop and invite, first of all, anybody who was in Hong Kong at the time to share a recollection of that period. And then we're open for Q&A for as long as you like. Thank you. Any reminiscences from anybody? Steve.
How did the authorities react, having cool children have to actually eat humble pie? Was that quite a satisfying experience, or did they not actually go as far as eating humble pie?
They were careful not to. Those two individuals, Bembridge was quite affable. I mean, he freely admitted he knew nothing about monetary systems. Haddon Cave was the real sort of bugaboo. He never acknowledged me. Dougie Bly never spoke a word to me. And even when I saw him at a Hong Kong Association event in London, you know, he turned and walked away. About a number of years later, I was awarded the OBE by another financial secretary, Hamish McLeod, for my services to Hong Kong. So they didn't acknowledge it with good grades or anything, I don't think. I mean, the two professionals in that meeting on the Saturday morning were Tony Latta, who was very good. He was on secondment from the Bank of England, and he was a supporter of my proposal, but you know, he hadn't had the authority to kind of write it up or be as radical as me. And the other one was Joseph Yam, who later became head of the Hong Kong Monetary Authority, ran it for 19 years and did a very good job. At that time, he was a junior statistician or economist working in the Treasury Department, seconded to the Monetary Affairs Branch. And at the time, I mean, he was learning by learning on. He was learning. So later, Joseph Yam and Tony Latta invited me to join the as an external member to become a member of the Hong Kong Monetary Authority's Committee on Currency Board Operations, and I'm still on that today. So I'm like an external member of the Monetary Policy Committee in this country, except that in Hong Kong we don't have to sort of set interest rates all the time. We meet quarterly, and while there are occasionally things to change or sort of tweak with the system, there's much less to do. Yes, Chris.
Just a few ideas. My name is Chris McCarthy. My wife and I were in Hong Kong in that period. In fact, I went there in 1978, and I think she followed a couple of years later. Yeah, met her. So we were there till 1984, first time there. We were there for 10 years, finishing in 2002. So we saw it both before the build-up to this.
Just hold that.
Yes, we saw it in the build-up to what John's been talking about, and also subsequently in the more stable period. And I'm not an economist. I was working, we were sort of both working for the Hong Kong government on the capital works program side, very big capital program at the time, one of the biggest in the world. So we weren't part of the sort of conversation that John is talking about, other than as intelligent laymen, I suppose. You know, one was always affected. I mean, when I went in 1978, my first overseas assignment, the idea of what currency was your base currency intellectually was important, and sterling was, because I was just out there on a contract, so sterling was clearly my base currency. So I was always looking to secure my earnings and my savings into that particular currency at the time. And so it was a daily thing for us to look at the exchange rates, a daily thing, sometimes a couple of times a day, just as an ordinary punter. It was that important, that critical. As we were moving towards the 1983 period, even more so was that important. And so it became just part of your cornflakes in the morning, that you just made sure what the currency was, and one would buy and sell into sterling whatever the rate was. But as John was saying, as that period went on and one got into the 80s and the 81, 82, and it was obviously much more unstable, then you had to do other things. You know, you used to go and buy Krugerrands and things like that, you know, physical gold and such like, because you wanted the stability that was there outside of Hong Kong, in a sense. Otherwise, your own certainty of your savings, such as they were hard-earned and not very great, of course, in those days, was quite important. Now, I remember one particular occasion, and I can't remember, it was on a Saturday, when in Hong Kong they have a thing called tax reserve certificates, which is, in a sense, you could buy in advance a certificate to pay your income tax. And they did attract a rate of interest. It's always a premium rate, a little bit of a premium rate. And so it was a normal thing for people like expats and some others to go and buy tax reserve certificates when you'd saved up a little bit of cash so that you could get the interest rate and so you could book, if you like, in advance, the fact you got some money to pay your tax when it was due. And these ones crept up and up and up, and the premium got bigger and bigger and bigger, wider, the gap wider with the market rate. And I remember on one occasion they raised it on a Friday to 16%. And there was going to be some massive announcement on the Sunday, possibly the one that John's talking about. One loses track of the details of that. And we used to work on Saturday mornings in those days. Everybody in Hong Kong worked on Saturday mornings. And the government worked on Saturday mornings. And I remember a mass exodus from my office, including me, on the Saturday morning, down to the bank to get all the money we could possibly find out of the bank in Hong Kong dollars, rush off down to the Inland Revenue Department's cash office and buy tax reserve certificates as much as we could afford at 16%, because you couldn't do any better on that, could you? And you were locking it in. You were locking it in. But I think the other thing that was one of the things that did cause a lot of instability that John was alluding to was there was a moment, I can't remember, he'll remember far better than I can, towards the end of this period, 82, 83, possibly, must have been 83, I think, if you had foreign deposits with the Hong Kong Bank in particular, obviously over the preceding years, that's where you put them, because in a sense they were isolated from the Hong Kong dollar, so they were secure, you thought. But actually, a rumour went round, which was not disabused by the chairman of the Hong Kong Bank on the day, that the very small print on page 143 of your contract with the Hong Kong Bank for that allowed them to unilaterally convert those into Hong Kong dollars and therefore disadvantage you, because essentially you hadn't got the cover of your foreign deposits. And so people like me got pretty shit scared about that, pardon the expression, and what do you do about it? So I mean, I went to all my money out of the Hong Kong Bank and I put it in Chase Manhattan, because an American bank had a different regulatory regime. I thought that was never tested, by the way, to the ultimate, because I couldn't trust the Hong Kong Bank that it wouldn't convert my US dollar deposit accounts into Hong Kong dollars. And so I'll stop at that time, John. But it was that sort of environment, rather sort of heated is not exactly the word for it. It was a seriously, seriously scary environment to operate in. Yeah, fever, that's the word I was looking for. And in a sense, one had to work on a real-time basis of Hong Kong dollars, what you wanted to know, and then do other stuff with the other things.
My wife didn't buy tax reserve certificates. She went out and bought jewellery and fur coats.
I thought you were pouring alpha.
Russell.
So it's pretty obvious that the colonial administration didn't understand monetary systems, but there's a huge bank in Hong Kong full of bankers. So, still there. Did none of them understand the monetary system? And second question, what was their reaction, the Hong Kong Shanghai Banking Corporation, to your plan?
Yeah, it's working. They had an economist there. His name was, I think it was D.K. Patel. Do you remember him?
No.
Okay. And he wrote very orthodox sort of stuff. And the government had an economist called, he was a Scotsman, Alan MacLean. Neither of them had really any sort of knowledge or experience of monetary systems. So basically he was like, D.K. was more like a journalist, just sort of doing a roundup of economic or financial news for the bank's monthly newsletter. There was one time when they did recommend a scheme, and I commented on that in my Asian Monetary Monitor, but it was hopeless. It was a bit like the government's proposal, you know, to sort of require the banks to hold more liquidity. It wasn't going to work. and I pointed out why it wasn't going to work. So, you know, I mean, the bankers were there to lend money and to take deposits. You know, that was their business. They weren't involved with the design of the monetary system or ensuring the stability of it. And I think that's the case with a lot of people. You work in a system and you take the system for granted. I don't think we can really blame them. But the people in government, you know, who were responsible for the monetary affairs branch, they should really have been the people to take responsibility for this.
I'll pass this.
We're recording it, so I'll give that to you.
Did the IMF have anything to say? I suspect perhaps not, because it would be a territory of the UK at that point.
That's right. I don't think Hong Kong had separate representation at the IMF at that time. Mm. And initially, the IMF was very hostile to currency board arrangements. They adopted the orthodoxy that the world was moving away from fixed exchange rates to floating rates, and the right way to manage things was to control money and credit and interest rate and thereby achieve price stability. That was the sort of intellectual academic model that they had in their minds. And a currency board, that was a fixed exchange rates. You don't want to have that. That's old-fashioned. That's, you know, back with the gold standard and the silver standard. But essentially what I was doing was in reintroducing the silver standard into Hong Kong. But instead of using silver, we were using the US dollar. And for Hong Kong, that was absolutely ideal, because although I said earlier that the exchange rate is the most important price in the country, if prices in the country and wages are very flexible, if you fix that one price, the exchange rate, then everything else has to fluctuate. So the way Hong Kong operated was in a way a kind of mirror image of other economies. Other economies would allow the exchange rate to adjust in order to get to gain a bit more competitiveness or achieve a bit more advantage or benefit the people by appreciation and therefore getting cheaper imports. Or, you know, those sort of ideas circulated. But in Hong Kong, it was the other way around. You'd fix the exchange rate and everything else would adjust. Prices, wages, the structure of industry, and so on. And it's become Hong Kong's role, in effect, to be the conduit for American financial markets into Asia. I mean, there is nowadays more securities issuance done out of Hong Kong than anywhere else in Asia, much more so than Tokyo or China or Singapore. So the fixed rate has enabled a lot of that pricing to be done, I think, because it's much easier to if you're basically fixed to the US dollar, you know what the interest rates are in US dollars, you know what they're going to be in Hong Kong, they're going to be very similar. All of that enables you to do that sort of securities pricing in a much more secure way than if the Hong Kong dollar had been floating, a very small place subject to large capital inflows and outflows, it would have been very volatile and much more difficult, and all that business would have gone somewhere else. So the remarkable thing about a currency board is that it enables a country or a territory to have this fixed rate system, but huge inflows and outflows, which really don't shift it. It remains rock solid. I was criticized in the early days after the system was set up, because journalists would come and say, well, Mr. Greenwood, you know, how long is the system going to last for? Surely, you know, it'll last a few years and then we'll go to a floating rate. And I said, no. It's a bit like the silver standard or the gold standard. It can last for hundreds of years. What? You can't believe that. You can't be serious. Well, here we are today, 2018. So that makes us 35 years since 1983. That means that this system has lasted longer than the Bretton Woods system of fixed exchange rates. Jamie.
John, I'm fascinated by making, sorry. If I may just follow up on that exact last point. I mean, to the extent that China is obviously far more relevant to Hong Kong than the US is economically, theory would suggest that that's the fixed exchange rate link that Hong Kong really should have. Now, that's made sense for a long time because the Chinese themselves have been pegged pretty much to the US dollar, or at least had a crawling peg. But I think one of the things that concerns a lot of people in financial markets is that the RMB will fall very hard against the dollar at some point. Do you worry that looking into the future that there is a threat to the currency board if the peg persists with the US dollar as opposed to the RMB?
Well, obviously I've thought about this a lot, and I have a section actually written at the end of the book on exactly that point. Currently, the US is the major driver of the global business cycle rather than China. China is a big importer of raw materials, but its financial connections with the rest of the world are pretty tenuous because of foreign exchange control. So the whole capital account is basically frozen or very limited. And the current account, trade and current account, is dominated by imports of raw materials. That's about one third of their imports. Another third is imports of semi-processed items that go into your laptop, your mobile phone, etc., your various digital devices. Those are then assembled in China and re-exported. So that demand is not determined by China either. That's determined by the rest of the world. And the other part, the other third of China's imports are things like capital goods and a few luxuries. What matters for Hong Kong is that Hong Kong is still driven essentially by the global business cycle. And as long as that is the case, it's better for Hong Kong to be fixed to the US dollar. It's very impractical to try to have a currency board arrangement with a currency that has exchange controls. That's not going to work because you won't get the interest rate arbitrage working in the way that it does work now between the Hong Kong dollar and the US dollar. So until China lifts foreign exchange control, which I do not expect in my lifetime, or China changes radically, you know, its structure so that if it becomes a big importer of manufactured goods from all over the world like the US is, and therefore has a big impact on the manufacturers and, you know, the production of other countries, the spillover effects are much bigger, it will continue to remain a sort of have a much smaller role. Now, of course, it's important for Hong Kong's imports of food or other items. But as you say, as long as the Chinese currency is basically mirroring the fluctuations of the US dollar, then I don't think there's really any need or urgency to change from a US dollar to the renminbi. As I say, it wouldn't work anyway satisfactorily. An interim type of arrangement, which I don't really support, would be to do what some of the Baltic countries did. Initially, countries like Lithuania and Latvia, after the fall of communism, they fixed their currencies to a basket which was essentially 50% US dollars and initially 50% Deutschmark. And then, of course, that got substituted with the euro. And now they've become members of the euro. So, you know, you could have a basket which was 50% dollars and 50% renminbi. But then you have the problem that the interest rate arbitrage is not nearly so clear, because you've got different rates in one country and different rates in another. Of course, you can work out a weighted average or an appropriate average, but, you know, it isn't absolutely elementary. And therefore, you know, there's a bit of friction thrown into the system. Next.
No, I think we're going to have to call it a day very soon.
Okay.
I'm sure we've got time for
one more. Here we go.
Thank you. When you look around Asia today, are there any currency regimes that you think are very poorly designed?
Well, I haven't studied Vietnam, which has the most volatile sort of movements of money and currency that I'm aware of. But I imagine it's a pretty orthodox type of central banking system, and it's just either politically driven or incompetently. So I don't think that's a serious problem. Singapore runs a very similar, well, it's more of a central banking arrangement, but it has a sort of managed peg arrangement. And that's very, very solid. So there's no problem there. And the others are all central banking mechanisms which operate in the orthodox way. So no, I don't see any sort of obvious currency arrangements which are going to fall apart. I'd like to study Mongolia because that's a system where they predominantly produce commodities, and the commodity price is obviously very variable. And it's been a real lesson, anybody who looked at it, to see what Russia has done in recent years. They used to have a fixed rate, and whenever the oil price went up, they had high inflation. When the oil price went down, then the economy crashed. They've recently moved to a floating rate, and that's insulated their economy hugely, and it's now much more stable. They still have a big structural problem because they're too much tied to energy. But Mongolia, you know, which produces only pretty much only commodities, would have a similar problem, you know, what to do. So that would be interesting to look at. But I don't think there's any obvious candidate that's going to experience what Hong Kong experienced in 1983.
King has no clothes, but sometimes it can be true in real life, and that's what John did in 1983. He walked into a room full of the good and the great and explained why the king had no clothes, and then he built the clothes. So it's quite a rare story. It doesn't happen very often. Can you remind me what age you were, John, when you did all that?